Continuing our sermon series on how ideas about the soul affect both individuals and society, a reminder that you can access audio recordings of prior installments on uucpa.org if you like. As usual, I'll start with a very condensed review of what's come before. In short, I've described how while the modern era has given humankind immense gifts, its dominant philosophy of materialism, which holds that physical matter constitutes the whole of reality, has also purged any transcendent or transrational, that is, beyond the rational, aspect from human life. And I've proposed that the resultant spiritual vacuum, what world religions scholar Houston Smith terms an abnormal condition for the human spirit, causes major personal and collective problems, and that archaic religious remedies only now aggravate these and related ills. Then, drawing on Plato, I offered a transrational template very different from those of traditional religions. The main points are that human beings have a soul and enter the world with a life blueprint and a personal calling and destiny. Plato also describes the soul's spirit companion, termed daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, in Greek, and genius in Latin, that guides the soul during its earthly excursion. And further, I propose that when people identify and live out this calling as wholeheartedly as possible, it's personally beneficial and culturally, potentially transformative. My latest installments then broadly describe the historical emergence of materialism's soulless worldview, including the very understandable reasons this abnormal condition first became normalized, which was largely to break free of religious tyranny. I summed up that process by contrasting two views of the modern era, as articulated by cultural historian Richard Tarnas. The first is of an epic narrative of human progress, a long heroic journey from a primitive world of ignorance, suffering, and limitation to a brighter modern world of ever-increasing knowledge, freedom, and well-being. Yet, referencing the Titanic, an archetypal embodiment of modern achievement and affluence, I offered the contemporary French cultural critic and philosopher Paul Virilio's observation that when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. Thus, the same cultural voyage that produced such enormous benefits has also produced unequaled devastation, including, as I discussed last Sunday, the devastation of indigenous peoples by Western colonialist and religious powers. This then suggests a very different outlook on modernity's story, one that, again in Tarnas' words, reveals a progressive impoverishment of human life and the human spirit, a ruinous destruction of the sacred community of being, a fragmentation of original unities. And of course, both accounts, the wondrous ship and the horrendous shipwreck, are simultaneously true. A paradox we'll continue to dissect as it relates to how perspectives on the human soul profoundly shape people's worldviews, and thus our own personal and collective reality. So, continuing now, as the fully modern 20th century unfolded, this paradox grew ever more apparent. Ironic incongruities embedded in two New York World's Fairs exemplify this split personality. The central symbol of the 1939 and 1940 The World of Tomorrow Fair consisted of two colossal structures, ultra-modern in both design and name. At 180 feet in diameter, the Perisphere Orb was an epic sight. Here's a painted postcard that gives you the perspective from across the fairgrounds. At the and this site was made even more awesome by being linked via what at the time was the world's longest escalator to the soaring 610-foot-high Trilon, short for Triangular Pylon. Let's go to the next slide. Surrounded by a reflecting pool. And here's another perspective. That's a photograph as opposed to a painting. And finally, in this cutaway drawing, you can't see much detail, but that's the inside of the perisphere. And there, visitors glided on a revolving observation platform above a diorama dubbed Democracy, that portrayed an ideal futuristic city, while high overhead, other world of tomorrow themed images flashed on the orb's cinema screen dome. Thank you, Kevin. So, quite impressive structures, yes? And here's the first ship and shipwreck irony. Of course, U.S. involvement in the lamentable conflict of World War II was necessary. Yet given what these world of tomorrow structures represented, it could hardly be more incongruous that at Fair's End, both were dismantled, and like so many other scrap substances at the time, their materials used to make armaments for the most destructive war in history. The U.S.'s key role in the Allied victory, coupled with unprecedented post-war prosperity, largely deflected attention from modernism's ruinous destruction face that Tarnas mentioned. And coming out of the Great Depression and that gruesome war, it's understandable that Americans longed for a let-up and for the ultimate triumph of modernism's epic narrative of human progress. That longing and its imagined fulfillment is evident in the tremendous popularity of an attraction at the 1964 and 65 New York World's Fair, where, in an updated complement to The World of Tomorrow, the General Electric Pavilion showcased Walt Disney's Progress Land. Subsequently brought to Disneyland's Tomorrowland District in 1967, it ran there through 1973 as the General Electric Carousel of Progress, complete with its own theme song, There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow. Which brings up a second ship and shipwreck irony. For in this same period, outside the Magic Kingdom, there were other lands with their own songs. During the Vietnam War that eventually left over 58,000 Americans dead, at least 21,000 permanently disabled, and roughly 830,000 veterans suffering some degree of post-traumatic stress disorder, the lyrics of a song by Country Joe and the Fish juxtaposed a great big beautiful tomorrow with a great big deadly today. Some of you will know this. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. The core feeling of that song's title, the I feel like I'm fixin' to die rag, had also been suffered by black Americans for centuries. Now, unrest and riots raged in many U.S. cities, fueled by systemic discrimination that contributed to high unemployment, limited affordable housing, underfunded education systems, and rampant police brutality in largely black neighborhoods. And more immediately, fired by numerous white supremacist attacks on supporters of inclusive civil rights. And while songs like Sam Cooke's 1964, A Change Is Gonna Come, expressed the anguished anticipation of liberation from bondage and suffering long heard in the spirituals of African American slaves, in 1968, James Brown captured the more proactive resolve of the emerging Black is Beautiful and Black Power movements. We'd rather die on our feet than keep a living on our knees. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. And black, white, and other, die people did. Songwriter Dick Holler's Abraham, Martin, and John mourned the 1968 political assassinations of two leaders who sought to rectify such injustices, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, as well as of JFK and Abraham Lincoln earlier. If you're not aware, John Wilkes Booth murdered Lincoln after hearing him speak of emancipation for black slaves. The lyrics include, "They freed a lot of people, but it seems the good, they die young. I just looked around, and they're gone." Like the Titanic and its iceberg, from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s, modernism's great, big, beautiful tomorrow also ran up against rising tides of women and non-heterosexuals, likewise demanding release from abusive subjugation, the Watergate scandal that exposed a flood of political misconduct and compelled a corrupt President Nixon to resign, and not least, a surging passion to curb modern industry's ecological destruction and contamination. Lyrical expressions on that last topic range from Joni Mitchell's poetic petition, "Hey, farmer, farmer, put away that DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees, please." To Tom Lehrer's droll satire, "Just go out for a breath of air and you'll be ready for Medicare." To the supreme irony of the surf-loving Beach Boys warning folks, "Don't go near the water." And in a different song of that title, performed by Johnny Cash, a father regretfully tells his boy they can't eat the tainted fish they're attempting to catch, before and after which the chorus intones, "Don't go near the water, children. See the fish all dead upon the shore. Don't go near the water, because the water isn't water anymore." And another verse could be said to encapsulate society's burgeoning ecological awareness as a whole. "We're torturing the earth and pouring every kind of evil in the sea. We violated nature, and our children have to pay the penalty." As in prior historical phases, together these and many similar outcries steadily created a critical mass of people who now found the present worldview and its practices intolerable. All the more startling for arriving at the zenith of modernism's carousel of progress affluence, this new cultural consciousness marked the full flowering of the latest historical course correction, now known as postmodernism. Just a few words on that term. There is no single definition or credo, and it's been variously applied in architecture, literary and cultural criticism, design and other fields and schools of thought. Yet it's generally agreed that the postmodern era emerged in the mid-20th century and acknowledges modernism's inherent ship and shipwreck contradictions. It also asserts that reality is far too complex and multifaceted to be comprehended or described by any universal truth, religious, ideological, or otherwise, and that any piece of the truth is inevitably distorted by unconscious human subjectivity from which we can never be fully free. That has its own contradictions and issues, which I'll explore another day. But in general, the basic willingness to consider multiple perspectives tends to foster better understanding of other peoples and, ecologically speaking, other beings, realities, and experiences, and thus is frequently a starting point for empathy, which can then seek improvements. And it's in this broad sense of a widening circle of moral concern, in the simplest terms, from me and mine to one and all, that it's used here. Political thinker and author Steve McIntosh encapsulates this more attentive and inclusive outlook. "The new we that coheres as the worldview of postmodernism is comprised of the victims of modernity, including individual people, races, and cultures, and the overall natural environment, together with those who are sensitive to the pain of victimization even though they may not have been directly victimized themselves. This is a collective parallel to something I spoke of last week, David Brooks recognizing the infinite value of all souls, in contrast to political and religious powers that often show themselves deaf and blind to others' value and their sufferings. A debility questioned earlier in the 60s by Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind. How many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Metaphorically, the hope is at least one that works, but sadly, some folks don't seem to possess even that. And after pausing for other service topics in May, in June, we'll explore some findings from neuropsychology that help us understand why and how this impairment constitutes a central underlying rift in our current cultural discord. Namaste and blessed be.